Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming. We're going to jump right into the program. I'd like to welcome you here. It's a pleasure for us to host you guys tonight, and thanks for buying your tickets. Help us pay for the event. But the first order of business for us is we want to thank our sponsors, and I'm sorry to put you through this, but these guys contributed tremendously to help make this a reality. And on your tables, there are little bags with some brochures and other information, a couple little goodies in there for you to take home. So please take them home with you. But our sponsors for tonight's event are Bahamas Mack Truck Sales, Bahamas Wholesale Agencies Limited, the British Colonial Hilton, the Luggage Store, Butterfield Bank, Cable Bahamas and Channel 12, who are graciously going to film it and show it for us later. CBS Bahamas, who you may have noticed in Saturday's paper, changed their name from Commonwealth Building Supplies, and so they're now CBS Bahamas. Custom Computers Limited, NMC Leasing, Security in General, Taylor Industries Limited, and Tropical Shipping. Without those, it certainly would not be a reality. Thank you. We're letting Larry Reed, our speaker, get a couple morsels of food down before we get going, but I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce one of our directors, Peter Young, to talk about an upcoming event. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to do a very short plug before anything else for these discussion groups, what we call them, which we're now organizing on a monthly basis. In October, we had Jorge Bolandelli, who is the Vice President of the EFG Trust and Bank Bahamas Limited. Jorge is here tonight, sitting just down here. He gave a very good talk to us about development theory and what can be done to relieve poverty. So that was a success. We had quite a few people in our new Milton Friedman room. We've had permission to call it that, and that's our little conference room in our offices on East Bay Street. Then in November, we had David Skorica. I think some of you came to that, looking around the room. He's an economist and financial advisor, and he gave us a good talk about economic freedom and its effect on markets. And in January, none other than Richard Coulson, Esquire, who everybody knows, and Dick's here tonight, gave us also an excellent talk on peak oil. Peak in the sense that oil reserves are finite and we better do something about it. 27 people, I think, turned out to listen to you, and we had a very good, lively discussion. So we're continuing these on a monthly basis, and we would encourage people to come. This is not, you're not being talked at, it's a discussion group, a presentation and then a nice discussion. The next event of this sort will be on the 6th of March here, and we've got Dr. Don Boudreau, who is the chairman of the Department of Economics at George Mason University in Virginia, and he's going to talk about globalization, very obviously a very important topic. He's going to make the economic case for it and explode some of the myths about protectionism, which we are all against. Could I just mention also that the sponsors for that, it's important for me to do this, but the sponsors for our meeting, same place, same time, 6th of March, are Bahamas Realty, Brass and Leather, CBS Bahamas, Custom Computers, the Dalbinas Agency, Executive Printers, NMC Leasing, RBC Finco, Security in General, Taylor Industries, and Tropical Shipping. So again, we can't do these events if we don't generate some money from these sponsors. So we're very grateful to them for the meeting on the 6th of March. Now, I'd like to invite our fellow director, Dr. Sidney Sweeting, who's going to introduce Larry Reed. Thank you.
Good evening. Our speaker tonight is no stranger to most of you. But being asked to introduce him, I started to go through his bio, and if I gave the total thing, we'd be here all night. So I tried to condense it as much as I could. And just for the interest of those who weren't here the first time I spoke. Mr. Lawrence Reed is the president of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, a Midland-based research and educational institute. The center's mission is to equip Michigan citizens and other decision makers to better evaluate Michigan public policy options and to do so from a free market perspective. Under his leadership, the Mackinac Center for Public Policy has emerged as the largest and one of the most effective and prolific of over 40 state-based free market think tanks in America. He served a term as president and 15 years as a member of the board of directors of the State Policy Network, a national organization whose membership consists of those state-based groups. In the past 20 years, he has authored over 1,000 newspaper columns and articles, 200 radio commentaries, dozens of articles in magazines and journals in the U.S. and abroad, as well as 5 books. Since 1978, he has delivered more than 1,000 speeches in 40 states and 15 foreign countries, including one at People's University in Beijing, China. It is a real pleasure and a privilege for the NASA Institute to have Mr. Lawrence Reed speak to us twice in 2 years, and it's my honor to introduce him tonight. Please give him a warm welcome.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sweeting. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be back. Many of you were here last year, and you came back anyway. I'm especially appreciative of that. I'm moving a little slowly tonight. I've had some sort of a bug for a couple weeks, and I hope it won't show. Maybe I shouldn't have told you, but just in case it does, I thought you'd better know. But I'm going to try to muster up the adrenaline tonight, and maybe it won't make a difference. I want to thank the NASA Institute once again for hosting my visit and the sponsors named this evening for this particular event. The NASA Institute has become very special to me because I have come to know the folks associated with it since its founding. And I want to say something that they did not ask me to say, but I think it's important to say this. When I look around the world at the work of organizations like the NASA Institute, and here in the Bahamas, I don't believe there is any other group quite like the NASA Institute, not with the same focus or mission and nature of work. I think that whether the future is a free one or not is going to depend in great measure on the work of institutes devoted to freedom. And that's one of the exciting things in the world today. There's a lot, as you look around, to be maybe a little disappointed in, but one of the exciting and positive trends is the fact that all over the world, institutes devoted to limited government and free markets and free enterprise are growing. And you have one right here in the NASA Institute. So I thank you if you're already supporting the Institute, and if you are considering becoming a supporter, I strongly encourage you to do so. We have a famous story in America that perhaps many of you have heard about Ben Franklin when he left the Constitutional Convention in 1787, the body that constructed our Constitution. A woman came up to him and very famously said, "Mr. Franklin, what form of government have you given us?" And his famous reply was, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." And his point, I'm sure, was that we put some great words on paper, and the finest that any people have ever produced for providing a structure of liberty and limited government for a free people. But in the end, that's all they are. They're just words. And if the people, succeeding generations of people, don't believe in them, don't practice them, don't teach them, don't inculcate those ideas behind them in the minds of young people, then it will simply be a matter of time before those ideas give way and government will be in the driver's seat. Freedom is not automatic. It's never guaranteed. It isn't something you'll always have because your parents had it or their parents had it. There are plenty of people around the world who will be happy to take it away, and either piecemeal or all in one fell swoop. which means it's incumbent upon people who believe in liberty to do something on its behalf. So, again, I thank you for your support of the Institute, and I encourage you to do all that you can to help it grow. My topic tonight is privatization, the promise of privatization. I want to start with a story. I've never been able to authenticate this, so I can't pass this off as true, but the person who gave it to me some years ago insisted that it was. It's an example, actually, of an effort at privatization that my guess is it didn't work out, but I don't know that for certain. But this comes from the Ukraine. Shortly after the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991, Ukraine was one of those former 15 Soviet republics that became an independent country. It is to this day. They had had for years a government tourist company in Kiev, in the Ukraine, which was standard procedure in those countries at that time. You couldn't have a private tour company that would privately bring in tourists and show them around. It all had to be run through the government. But when Ukraine became a separate country, they began to privatize some things, turn more functions and duties and activities and services over to private enterprise, and a group of former government employees formed a private tourist company called Kiev Tourist. And according to this story, one of their early announcements was of group tours of Chernobyl, the site of the 1986 nuclear disaster. And the tour brochure supposedly explained that it included the city of Chernobyl, a visit to the concrete sarcophagus that envelops the reactor, or at least from some distance you supposedly could see something of it, a nearby radioactive waste dump, and a nearby town populated by radiation-exposed workers, whose motto, the promotional brochure stated, was, "Life is good, but too short." The brochure also reportedly stated that the tour begins and ends with a Geiger counter check of tourists, just for reassurance. Anyone needing treatment afterwards for radiation exposure will receive it at no extra charge. I don't know if that's true, and if it is true, I don't know what happened with that company, but I would think that'd be a very tough sell. And my guess is that a private firm that tried to sell that tour wouldn't be around for very long. They'd have to find something else to do. Would you believe that 25 years ago, the term privatization was not yet even in a dictionary? It was in the middle or early 1980s when I was writing a column in some papers out in the western part of the United States, and I was reading some work of Bob Poole from the Reason Foundation, who really has done a lot of pioneering work in this area of privatization. And so I decided this is worthy of a column. So I wrote a column about this emerging new trend that showed some great promise called privatization. And within a couple of weeks, a competing columnist in one of the Idaho papers ran a column just dismissing the whole concept. And out of hand, without much in-depth study whatever. But he said this isn't going anywhere, and his main reason for saying that was that he looked in Webster's dictionary and privatization wasn't even a word. So how where could it go if it wasn't even a word that anybody was really using? Some oddball in Southern California coined the term, and it wasn't probably going to go anywhere. Well, funny thing has happened on the way to oblivion. Privatization is now not only a term in the dictionary, it is a policy in many parts of the world. And although progress in this direction is sometimes three steps forward, two steps backwards, I can tell you that it has been one of the mega trends of the last 20 years and shows every sign of continuing to be so as far into the future as the eye can see. I hope to tell you more about why that's the case in many parts of the world before my talk is done. But I need to tell you what I mean by privatization. How would we define the term? I give it the broadest possible definition. It's simply the transfer of either assets or the provision of services from the public to the private sector. That's the broadest possible definition. The transfer of assets or of the provision of services from the public to the private sector. Defined that way, you then can break it apart and look at the various methods by which it has been done. And then I'll give you some reasons why it's being done. But let me cite for you some of the means by which privatization has been achieved. This is becoming increasingly somewhat of a science, by the way. There are conferences all over the U.S. now, and maybe many parts of the world, intending to draw leaders of government to learn how to do this and how to do it right, how to avoid the pitfalls. The most common method in our country, in the U.S., or my country, is contracting out. And this obviously involves the provision of a service where the government says, we used to provide this service, and we did it with our own employees, in many cases unionized, but now we're going to contract with a private firm or multiple firms, or maybe even a nonprofit, or maybe even just gin up some volunteers. In some cases, certain services have been taken over by volunteers. But at least contracting out means that no longer is a service to be provided by a government monopoly with government employees. It'll be provided with some degree of competition from private sector providers. The competition comes from the fact that the contract says you must do it this way, and we're not going to give you this service for the next 50 years. It will be renewable every 2 years, 3 years, whatever, which means that the contractors have to do it well or lose the contract. And if the government is doing its job properly, it will monitor and supervise that contract, write it well to begin with, and end up providing the service at lower cost and with higher quality in the process. That's the most common method. The second method I want to cite is actually my preferred method, personally. It's the method I would prefer wherever it is feasible. It isn't in all cases, but I like it because it really cuts the ties between government and the provision of a service altogether. And there are services, I think, that are best served this way. It's called commercialization. This is where government says, we used to do this ourselves. We did it as a government monopoly. We provided the service with government employees, paid for with taxes, but we're going to get out of it altogether. We're done. We're not going to do this service anymore. We're going to leave it to individual citizens and taxpayers to get it done themselves. The example I often cite is from Traverse City, Michigan. Some years ago, although there are many, many, probably thousands of examples of this around America, of services and places that have privatized by this method. A few years ago, Traverse City said, we're out of the garbage collection business. We used to do that, pick up garbage, haul it away to the landfill with government employees, but now we're done. We're not going to contract for it with private firms. We're just going to get out of it altogether. Each citizen now must provide for himself, find a private garbage pickup service, look in the Yellow Pages, they said. In fact, we have at the Mackinac Center, we have a Yellow Pages test when it comes to the role of government. We think that if you can find it in the Yellow Pages, chances are government doesn't need to do it. But in Traverse City, they said, each and every one of you, within certain rules, you can't let your garbage pile up, you can't throw it in your neighbor's yard, but now you decide who you want to pick up your garbage for you. My little town of Midland, Michigan, has always done it, as long as I can remember, with its own government garbage collection workforce. So that's what I was accustomed to. But in the mid-80s, I moved west for a couple years, first to Fort Collins, Colorado. And when I moved in there, I asked my neighbor, what day does your garbage get picked up? And he said, Thursday. So Thursday morning, I put my garbage out at curbside, and later when I came back home, his garbage had been picked up, but mine was still there. So when I saw him, I said, what's the deal? I thought you said garbage got picked up on Thursday. And he said, well, that's when mine gets picked up. I don't know when yours gets picked up. You have to look in the Yellow Pages. Who did you hire? And I said, I didn't hire anybody. I thought the city did it, just as was the case back in Midland, Michigan. So I had to find a private provider and contract with them. And I have to tell you that as mundane a service as garbage pickup is, I was thrilled by being able to pick my provider. I felt empowered. I felt a little freer as a citizen. I thought, I'm in charge here. If I'm unhappy with the service, I don't have to show up at some city council meeting and get in line and have the city councilman look down their nose at me and end up fighting some bureaucracy. If I don't like the service, if they don't deliver it the way they promised, I can fire them. I can find another one. I can complain to them and say, fix this or I'll hire somebody else. So in that sense, I felt empowered and I felt a little bit freer. So wherever this is feasible, and it tends to be feasible where you have a multiplicity of nearby private providers, where you have expertise in a particular service within range, as opposed to a distant mountain village somewhere where this may not be as viable an option. But wherever it is, I prefer it because you get the service done quickly, efficiently, and you're in charge if anything goes wrong. A third form of privatization is the sale of assets. This doesn't involve a service. It involves physical plant and equipment or a factory or machinery, airports, whatever. The sale of assets where government says, we're out of this. We don't need it anymore. We're going to get the best we can for it, put it on the market, and let a private buyer of it do with it as they wish. Another form is vouchers. Vouchers are often thought of in regards to education, but they could really apply to any number of things. In fact, think of it. In our country, we have food stamps. And I have a lot of problems with the food stamp program. I think it encourages some bad habits. I think it's costly and inefficient. There's a lot of waste involved in food stamps given to people below a certain income level. But I have to say that if you want to help poor people, and let's say your only options are to give them a voucher that they can use at a private provider, or have government-run farms, government-owned farms, and government grocery stores, and tell them you must buy your groceries from the government grocery store we assign you, I'd pick the voucher method any day of the week, because at least it leaves some measure of choice in the hands of the recipient. They're not hemmed in by a bureaucracy that tells them, here's what you're going to get, like it or leave it. It does preserve a measure of individual freedom and competition. And I predict that over time, you'll see more of the use of vouchers in more than just education in the United States and elsewhere. Another form of privatization takes is ending subsidies. This is often not listed when people talk about it. They don't think of ending subsidies as a way to privatize. But I think that anything that severs the lifeline, or you might say the umbilical cord from the tax trough to recipients and instead encourages them to stand on their own feet is a form of privatization. In the 1980s, New Zealand made dramatic changes in the direction of a free economy. They brought down the share of government in their economy from about 60% to 40% in the space of 2 to 3 years. One thing that they did was they took the heavily subsidized agricultural industry and just threw it open to the marketplace. They said no more subsidies. They ended all subsidies from the government to agriculture. And there was a painful wringing out process, no question about it. But the ones that survived were the efficient farms. And New Zealand agriculture was healthier in the long run because of the ending of subsidies. Because instead of producing for politicians, farmers began producing for the marketplace, which makes eminently more sense. Another form of privatization is the sale of stock to the public. This is where we take an enterprise, could be, well, in Britain, British Telecom. Margaret Thatcher did British Telecom, took it private by this method, by sale of stock in a newly privatized British Telecom and sold it to the general public. And finally, another form is ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans. This is, again, the sale of stock, but with a focus on the employees of a company. Well, by whatever method or methods you may choose to look at privatization, I think it's fair to say that compared to 25 years and before ago, this is really a revolution. For most of the last century, the trend was in the direction of nationalization, of ever more government control of industry, of takeovers, and of heavily subsidized industries and so forth. And although that is still happening in some places, most notably in Chavez's Venezuela, or Morales's Bolivia, North Korea did it so thoroughly there's nothing left for them to take, But by and large, there aren't too many places where nationalizations are taking place. It's deregulation and privatization that seems to be the trend in the last 25 years, although a lot of us believe there's a long ways to go. We owe a great debt to Margaret Thatcher in Great Britain for teaching us a lot about privatization, not only why it is advisable, but also how to do it right. When Thatcher came to power in the late 70s, she inherited a moribund British economy, dominated by powerful labor unions that often paralyzed British industry. Industry after industry had been nationalized, and they became white elephants, costing the Treasury huge amounts of money. She decided this was unsustainable. It was draining the Treasury. Industries, once taken over by the government, didn't make things cheaper, didn't make things better. Inevitably and invariably, service got worse and costs went up. She said, we need to move in the other direction to help stimulate an entrepreneurial culture. But she didn't go about it willy-nilly. She didn't just say, okay, British Telecom, your history. Instead, she said, we're going to sell stock in these companies, formerly state-owned companies, and the new private owners of the stock will be the owners of the company instead of the government. But she said, we're going to give the employees, the government employees, first crack at the stock. I think you all know why she did that, because the natural constituency to oppose privatization would be the employees of a government enterprise. They like things the way they are. They're not interested in competition, typically. And so they see privatization as a threat. So Thatcher thought, well, we can't have these people paralyzing these industries and dragging their feet and preventing a successful privatization. So we will give them first crack at the stock. We'll let them buy it first at a discount from what we think it will fetch in the marketplace later. And many British Telecom employees did just that. They bought stock only to see the value soar when the company went public. And instead of massive strikes, British Telecom employees went along with it, and it was a peaceful, quiet, successful transformation of an industry from public to private. Thatcher taught us that. She also sold, by the way, 1 million units of council housing, or as we in the U.S. would call it, public housing. And I'll never forget a wonderful story in the Wall Street Journal front page about this very phenomenon. After she had sold many, many of these public housing units, this story focused on how it transformed neighborhoods. And it talked about how a previously publicly owned section of housing, which had been decrepit, falling apart, crime in the streets, nobody was repairing broken windows. After all, no one had a direct and personal interest in such things. And you know, why would you, as a tenant, invest in fixing anything when it wasn't your property? Instead, you'd have to complain to some distant bureaucracy and hope they'll show up. Margaret Thatcher sold the units to the tenants for as little as 20 or 30 cents on the dollar. Now, you might say, well, taxpayers should have gotten more for the money. That might have been about the most they could have gotten at that point because so much of this property was so run down. But the idea was, get it out of the hands of the government, where it's declining precipitously. Get it into the hands of those who have the most direct interest in preserving and enhancing it. Let them have a share of ownership and see what happens. And some of those neighborhoods, by the way, changed their political leanings, too, from Labor to Conservative, in part because the Labor Party's initial reaction to this was horror. They said, who was the guy that ran against Thatcher the second time? Michael Foote, you remember him? What a radical socialist he was. He promised that if he won the election and came to power, he was going to swipe all that property and take it back in the name of the people. So you're a tenant now, formerly government housing. Now you got it in your name, and this guy comes along and says he's going to take it from you again. Who are you going to vote for? So this Wall Street Journal story talked about how these neighborhoods were transformed. People started fixing things. They formed neighborhood associations to keep an eye on criminals and try to shut down the drug trade. All of a sudden, they took the pride of ownership that comes with private property. That's a lesson that free people should not have to be told. But so many of us fall prey to the siren song of socialists who often tell us, well, only if the people are in charge, if the people own it all, the people's interests will be taken care of. But that rarely happens. Instead, it means the politicians' interests are cared for and property only declines in value. Now, why is this happening around the world? At various paces, sometimes we see a spurt and then it falls back, but privatization, by and large, has been a continuous trend for 25 years. I'll give you several reasons. One is ideological. There are some occasions and in some places where it's being done clearly for ideological reasons, and I don't mean this in any negative way. I'm talking about places like former Soviet satellite countries that have simply decided we had it up to our eyeballs in government ownership of this or that. We don't think it works. We're just interested in getting this stuff in the hands of those with who have the incentive to keep them up. The Czech Republic privatized a lot of things, and it didn't matter to a lot of Czechs, how to do it so much as it mattered just to get it out of government hands because they were convinced that doesn't work. Now, that's not typically the reason. Let me give you an interesting example here. As much of a believer in freedom as I am, I rarely tell people just privatize for the heck of it. I tell them, privatize after you've done your homework, carefully considered how to do it, make sure you do it right, don't do it wrong, all the cautionary notes and so forth. Don't rush into it. Do it right. But there are occasions when I would say, privatize. I mean, do your homework, but just get it done because it isn't a function of government to begin with. A few years ago, the city of Dayton, Ohio, was seriously considering getting into the pizza business. Really, the city council debated this. Somebody proposed on the council that they have government-owned pizza parlors. Now, that doesn't pass the Yellow Pages test, does it? You can find pizza in the Yellow Pages. Now, they ended up not doing that, but if they had, well, then government-owned pizza parlors, even if they made good pizza, would be something I'd say get rid of, sell. It's not a function of government. Chances are, if the government does more in areas where it doesn't have expertise or beyond its core function, it's going to neglect the things it's supposed to be doing. So even if it does make good pizza, it probably will be at the expense of getting more important things done that it's supposed to do. That would be a case of privatized just for the sake of it, because it's not a proper function of government. A few years ago, a good friend of mine is the former prime minister of Mongolia. He has been prime minister twice. He was a student activist in the anti-communist movement in the early 1990s that successfully removed the communist regime in Mongolia without firing a single shot. He's been prime minister twice now. And after his first prime ministership, when he visited us in Michigan, he gave a speech and he was telling us how proud he was of something he accomplished in his first term. He said, all the yaks in Mongolia, you know what a yak is, those big hairy cattle? He said, we had 25 million yaks. And for 75 years under communist rule, they were all government property. And he said, I decided that yaks were not a core function of government. So I sold them. He said, I sold all 25 million yaks. We worked up a plan. We sold the yaks to the herdsmen. And now, instead of having a stagnant yak population of 25 million, we've got 32 million already. Because the private herdsmen now have direct incentive in husbanding the resource because they make money to the extent they use the resources wisely. So there's another case of privatized for the sake of it. If your government owns yaks, I think you can confidently say it ought to get out of that business. Another reason, aside from ideological reasons, that privatization happens is because governments reach what I call the tax wall. They reach a point where they finally understand what they should have known all along, that they are not an island, that they do compete in the world, that what happens elsewhere does affect them, what they do to themselves does affect their ability to compete, and they're at the point where raising the tax burden any higher will only have deleterious effects. It will drive people and businesses elsewhere. And so, yet they want to do things, they want to provide services or whatever, and so what do? They can't raise taxes anymore to pay for it. Maybe they're at their limit as far as what they can borrow or what taxpayers will allow them to borrow. In some cases, they may have hit a constitutional barrier that limits how much bigger government can get, and so they're feeling the pressure. Then, for reasons of this tax wall, they decide we got to shed something. We have to privatize, save some money, privatize in one form or another. Another reason is purely pragmatic. Maybe they're not up against the tax wall, but they're just at the point where they need a new airport, but they don't know how to build one. Bureaucrats don't know how to build or manage an airport, maybe. So they say there's lots of expertise in the private sector for that, so we'll let the airport expansion be entirely a private affair. Maybe new technologies have come along to outpace whatever they've been doing in the provision of some service, so government says let the market handle that because it can do it better. At the federal level in the United States, this is the hardest level of government to privatize anything. A lot of us have virtually given up on Washington. It's distant, it's humongous, it's insensitive, it seems to lumber along of its own momentum and weight, irrespective of what the folks back home are saying, and so some people just tuned it out. I remember back in the 80s, some of us, when I was living out west, we were arguing for the government to get out of power marketing. The federal government had five power marketing administrations, and we said, we don't need that. There's lots of private power producers in the country. Why have we got federal power marketing administrations? Congress actually passed a law forbidding any expenditure of federal money by any agency or the Congress to even study the privatization of any of the federal power marketing administrations. So the special interests there who wanted to keep things the way they were, they got their way. They basically said, we don't want anybody even talking about this. And that sort of thing is one reason why Washington is such a tough nut to crack. But you talk about the state level, there's lots of it going on. In fact, my state of Michigan for years held the record in terms of the largest privatization in the sale of an asset of any of our 50 states. In 1995, Michigan sold off its workers' compensation insurance company. And this is one of the successes of our little institute. In fact, we authored the first study suggesting the sale of the accident fund, as it was called. We said, look, there are lots of people in a thriving insurance market providing private insurance. Why do we want a state agency rigging the rates, driving private competitors out? Let this be thoroughly private. And so Governor Engler sold it, and there was a one-time revenue income of $250 million, $250 million in the sale of the accident fund in 1995. Of course, there were all sorts of predictions, you know, workers will be hurt and accident fund insurance will soar and all those terrible things that never happened but are always argued by the left when anything is proposed to go private. It's at the local level, however, that we see the greatest privatization revolution taking place. Cities, counties, school districts even, all across our country, and I think it's true in many countries around the world. There, I think governments are closest to the people. You have a lot of ordinary, common sense people, some of them business folks. They are still running their business when they go to become a city council member, so they want city government to run with at least half the efficiency that they've experienced in their business. They tend to be no-nonsense, less subject to political parties and all that sort of thing. They just want to get the job done. And there you see privatization happening all across our country and in a bipartisan fashion. You name the service. I don't care what it is. Even police and fire. Solid waste collection, county jail operation, road and street maintenance, tree trimming and planting, snow removal, street lights, lawn mowing, wastewater treatment, legal services, parks and recreation, you name it. It wouldn't take me 5 minutes to be able to find for you and direct you to details on dozens, if not hundreds, of examples of successful privatizations of those services all across our country. We even have in California whole cities now that are called contract cities. They may be 50,000, 100,000 people and only have a half a dozen government employees. You know why? Because that half a dozen simply monitors contracts performed or carried out by private firms. They're contract cities. They don't have massive government bureaucracies providing services. Private sector doesn't. Towns like Phoenix and Indianapolis in the last 20 years have pioneered in unique ways to privatize. Those two cities are known for the fact that they've even allowed their public sector employees to be a part of the bidding. They will say, okay, this service, we used to do it with government monopolies, garbage pickup, whatever, and they've worked up arrangements whereby city employees can come back and organize as a private service-providing agency and bid for the services. And about a quarter of the contracts in Indianapolis have been won back by consortiums of public employees. The key thing is you give them that opportunity, and all of a sudden, by the way, public employees think differently. Mayor Goldsmith of Indianapolis some years ago talked about this at length. He said, you know, used to be that you couldn't get them to really ever get a fire lit under them. But when all of a sudden you say, hey, now you have to compete, they start to say, you know, maybe we don't need this many supervisors. Maybe we don't need that many coffee breaks. Maybe there are some ways to get this done better and cheaper. When the incentives are there, they behave differently. Mayor Goldsmith used to say when he came into office, he told city workers, there are no sacred cows. We're going to look at everything. And my favorite comment of his was, sacred cows make the best burgers. So he really put city employees on notice that you better shape up or be eaten. How much time do we have before we should end here? Should I wrap it up? Okay, because I have a few more examples and then a few other points. Maybe in about 10 minutes I can conclude here. I'd love to give some examples from our state of Michigan because I know those best. We actually have a publication called Michigan Privatization Report that we produce that monitors this activity all over the state. And you might think, well, public education, that's probably relatively immune to the pressures of competition and private provision and what have you. And certainly in Michigan, it's the home of our most powerful labor union, the Michigan Education Association. Many years ago, the MEA produced a document meant for internal use only, but it slipped into our hands. And in this document, they declared where they were going to stand on this topic of privatization that was beginning to catch public attention. And they said they would oppose any privatization, any contracting out for any school support service, that would be like food service, custodial, busing. They would oppose any privatization of any of those services by any school district anywhere in the state at any time. Surprise, surprise. They're called the teachers union, but they also have as their among their members the cooks and the food service workers and the bus drivers. So they have an obvious incentive to try to prevent this from happening. Well, we got to work at the Mackinac Center to figure out, you know, how do we show the public that this is simply nonsensical? This hurts children. This wastes money. Competition in the provision of services helps everybody if it's done right. Well, we did studies showing what districts could save if they contracted more competitively for services. We pointed to districts around the country that were doing it, showing what we showed that in Massachusetts, a very liberal democratic state, 95% of children going to school in the morning in Massachusetts ride on privately owned and managed buses. There's virtually no government busing of students in Massachusetts. In Michigan, time and again, all across districts, the government's school boards own buses, they run buses, it's all done with government employees. Well, what really got to the union, though, and really changed our law, was this. We were sitting around a table one day, and we thought, well, what about the union itself and its own headquarters? in East Lansing. It has 600 employees at the Michigan Education Association headquarters. Do they have, at this sprawling headquarters, do they have their own full-time in-house bureaucracy of food service, unionized food service workers, and or do they contract out for some of these things? Wouldn't it be great to kind of catch them in the act of doing the things that they oppose school districts doing? And I like to say that being a full-service think tank, we not only do studies, we do stakeouts when necessary. So we sent an employee down who spent a couple days in a parking lot across from union headquarters and watched vendors coming and going, and we later contacted the vendors and confirmed all this and issued a news release. Our headline was, Mackinac Center praises MEA for cutting-edge management techniques. And we showed that at their own union headquarters, they were contracting with private firms for all of their food service, their custodial, their security, their mailing, other services, and that 3 out of 4 firms they were contracting with were non-union. And then later, when the UAW was grappling with General Motors over outsourcing, we did the same with them and showed that, among other things, their own union newsletter was contracted to a non-union private printer. So they don't always do, when their own dollars are at stake, what they want school districts or other employers to do. I'm happy to say that making that revelation known about the MEA was a big factor in our legislature passing a law that took the privatization of school support services off the list of mandatory topics at the bargaining table, which has meant that ever since, if a school district wants to look into that, wants to contract with private firms for these services, it's actually an unfair labor practice for the teachers' union to raise it at the bargaining table. The school board can say, we don't have to talk to you about that. We'll talk to you about teacher salaries and benefits and what have you. But when it comes to cleaning the floor, that's our business, and we'll get it done the way we want to get it done. Now, what do you think about it? The union loves to say, well, see, this is putting public education up to private profiteers. When you think about it, think of all the things in public education that have always been, to some degree, private. How about the chalk that teachers write on the chalkboard with? Does that come from government chalk factories? No, we buy that. How about the pencils? How about the desks? How about the computers? I mean, on down the list, the textbooks. If they were really consistent in their thinking, the union would say, we got to feed those school kids with food grown on collective farms by government employees. We got to buy chalk from government chalk factories. I mean, how much sense would that make? So we already understand the inherent virtue in a collaboration with private people. It's just a matter of stretching our thinking a little bit to realize that there are other things that don't have to be done by government monopolies. Well, let me address some of the objections to privatization, and then we'll be done. I group the objections to it in 2 categories. The non-libertarian ones, not related to liberty, and then what I think are the really valid ones, the more libertarian objections, liberty-based objections to it. Under the non-libertarian ones, one of those objections is that, well, it's anti-public employee. We still hear this. It's been going on for 25 years, but still you hear from the unions in particular, they say, you want to privatize. You just don't like public employees. You've got it in for government workers. You want to just throw them out. What is it that you've got against government workers? And to that, those of us who support privatization say, wait a minute. We're talking about if there's a legitimate concern because they've been on the job a long time. Well, you can do like Thatcher did, give them first crack if it's a sale of stock. You can do other things, bake it into the contract. You know, the various things you can do if you feel it necessary to allow for some transition. But ultimately, it's not the government's function to be an employment agency. The purpose of the government is not to build a workforce. The purpose is to provide certain services, certain functions, and get it done at the lowest cost, and otherwise leave people alone. It isn't. Its purpose is not to simply hire as many people as it can. Another objection is, it's anti-minority. I mean, you look at cities that are whose majority population is actually a minority group, like in Detroit, and you'll find that they tend to gravitate into government positions. And so when somebody argues for privatization, there'll be that objection that, well, this is going to hurt minorities. This is anti-minority. If you privatize, that means probably instead of having a secure job with local government, this inner-city minority person is going to have to compete with a white suburbanite from a private company or something. And again, I have to go back to the first objection, which is, or the answer to the first one, which is, what's the purpose of government? Is it to be an employment agency, or is it to provide certain core services, allow for the greatest opportunity for an entrepreneurial climate to grow and to provide jobs? And what's better in the long run, a government job in a declining city with sky-high taxes to pay for it all, or a job in a growing, thriving, entrepreneurial city? You look at Detroit, they've gone the route of, you know, let's pack the payroll, and it's one of the sickest cities in America. It's lost about, it's gone from 2 million in population down to 750,000 in the last 45 years. I don't know that there's another major American city that, in fact, has declined more dramatically than Detroit. So government hasn't done minorities much good there. Another objection is, it's an attempt to destroy government. Mayor Goldsmith of Indianapolis used to love this one. He loved answering it. He would say, attempt to destroy government. Privatization? He would say, wait a minute. I, as mayor, when I decided I could bid services out, even if it meant involving former government employees among the bidders, he said, all of a sudden, as mayor, I felt empowered. I felt as though I was really in charge of the city after all, because if the service wasn't being done well, I could contract on behalf of the people with someone else. So I said, we didn't feel as we were privatizing things, we didn't feel we were destroying government. We were improving service and getting it done at lower cost. Then you have an objection into this in this first category that often does at first glance carry some real weight. And that is where people will look at instances where it didn't work. And they'll say, they privatized this, and then it went downhill. Well, almost always, when you look more closely at those examples, you'll find the reason why it failed was they didn't do their homework in the first place. They rushed into it. They did some very sloppy contract writing. Or the government didn't do its proper function afterwards and properly supervise and monitor the contracts. All these things that made it fail. Or they contracted in the first place they transferred a public monopoly and made it a private monopoly. Or they gave it to political cronies instead of allowing full-scale, regular market competition. That's the rap on much of Russian privatization under Boris Yeltsin. You know, he was in favor of it, but he didn't take care to see that the way it was done would encourage support for it. Instead, too much of the former bureaucracy and Communist Party members got in line first and got the assets, causing resentment across the Russian public. So you got to do it right. And sometimes, in fact, it's better to not do it at all than to do it wrong, because doing it wrong often means that at some later date, government's just going to come back in, take it all over, and you have all the problems you had in the first place after expending a lot of costs to get there. Now, let me give you a couple libertarian objections that do concern me. I think that these have some real weight. One is that unless you commercialize, like Traverse City did with garbage, getting out of it altogether, if you just have government involved through government contracting, it still leaves government in charge of spending other people's money. And there are always reasons for concern and care, need for attention and vigilance there. And if you let down your vigilance as citizens, then you can open the door to abuse and then privatization gets a bad rep. It can even breed new special interests, people who like the fact that government is a heavy buyer of their services. And so they lobby for more of that, even if, in fact, there isn't a genuine case to be made for it. And then sometimes government may privatize in order to save money, but then squander the savings. Ideally, if government is saving money, they then ought to either use the savings for a higher priority duty and get that done well, or cut taxes if they've got a high tax environment that's driving people away. But the last thing you wanted to do was to save money on this function and then take it and throw a party with it, or reward political cronies, or expand government into some other area where it has no business, or just waste it in one form or another. So the bottom line is, no matter how you do it, you still got to be vigilant. Thomas Jefferson told us over 200 years ago that the natural tendency seems to be for government to grow and liberty to retreat. And even though we can point to some promising interest and trends in involving the private sector more, we still have to be vigilant, because quite often when these things are done, it still leaves government in a commanding position where they do it wrong and invite abuse and further intervention later. But with that, let me just say, I know I'm not an authority on Bahamian economics. Maybe these things have different applications to current issues here, but I hope I've given you some philosophical backdrop to the concept anyway that might help you as you go forward here. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Yes, ma'am.
I think it's very easy to justify privatization from an economic perspective. But if you take, you quoted Margaret Thatcher a few times as an example. If you look at some of the long-term implications of that, there has been a trend over the last few years of seeing problems as a result of a lack of a crisis situation where the government has then had to bail out a company. It takes like Railtrack, mm-hmm. and there were several disasters on the railways, and they had they investigated it, and the report said the problem is gross lack of reinvestment in the maintenance and development of Railtrack. And then the answer seemed to be, so the government will give you $50 million yeah. to help you out.
Yeah.
And that seems to be becoming something of a trend. Another issue that seems to be coming out of long-term implications is, in some areas, an issue of quality. You said when you introduce competition, people change the way they behave.
Mm-hmm.
And you quoted lots of things about schools and providing services. If you take schools as an example, in the UK, they privatise the service of food provision in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And the outcome was a serious decline in the quality of the food that was provided. And it went from meat to veg, the traditional English school dinner, to chicken nuggets and burgers. And there are educational and serious health implications of that. But of course, the people offering the chicken nuggets and the burgers came up with the best bid, so they got the jobs.
Well,
if you look at lots mm-hmm. of areas in health, they're giving out cheaper drugs, not the best drugs, because they do now an assessment of side effects versus cost.
Yeah.
So it has changed the way people are thinking and behaving, but it's brought up, health for all its faults in the olden days.
Mm-hmm.
Only consideration of a doctor was health. What is the best drug? Now the doctor has to consider health and cost. So, in lots of areas that there are implications in the long term.
Oh, well, I hardly know where to begin, but let me say that cost has always been a factor in healthcare.
You couldn't tell that in the 70s in England.
Well, it shows up in different ways, okay? It wasn't as though the government thought, hey, the pot of money that we can use to spend for healthcare is utterly limitless. It never was. And it showed up in the form of long lines to get operations. I don't have the numbers.
Lack of treatment.
Or lack of treatment, yeah. Yeah, so you need your gallbladder out, but you get in line, and maybe in 18 months you'll get it out. Now, what prompts that is cost, because when things are offered at little or no cost directly to the recipient, it simply increases the demand for it, invites all kinds of inefficiency, and you end up getting rationed, but it doesn't show up in price. It shows up in lack of availability.
But in a service like health and schools, that actually hasn't changed.
Well, a lot of what you're describing, I think, is symptomatic of the, more broadly speaking, the general disease of the welfare state. I can tell you that you're going to find continued decline. I don't care whether you leave it in private hands or you have the government take it over again. Unless things change in places like Britain, you're going to see continued decline in services. And why? Because you have this general trend. Thatcher reversed it briefly, but now it's back in place, where we expect government to grow and to provide an increasing share of our life. And instead of taking it 40% of our incomes, it's taking 50%, 60%, 70%. I cannot find a single welfare state ever tried on the planet where, over the long haul, services improved and became more inexpensive. It only makes them worse. It only makes them more expensive. With regard to the schools, I'd like to know more about, all right, the schools that found the food quality going down. Why on earth did the, how'd they do that? Did they contract with private providers to commit? Okay. So it sounds like a pretty darn poor contract. If the kids are getting increasingly poor food, well, if the government's doing the contracting, why aren't they blowing the whistle? Why didn't they write a contract that said we want food of a certain quality?
Because it's cheaper to have chicken nuggets and burgers.
In general, England should look at former colony New Zealand. They are experts in contract management and contract writing.
Yeah.
They have even unemployment is managed by the private company.
Yeah. You're not telling me that the British are incapable of writing a contract that assures high quality food. Okay, well, I would say the government's pretty darn bad at contract writing. Quit buying it.
Still takes 9 to 10 months to see a specialist.
In Britain?
Uh-huh. That recent example was about 3 months ago in my daughter.
Yeah.
9 months to see a specialist. It was solved by having her come here and going to a doctor in the Bahamas and then one to the United States.
Yeah, what concerns me about, among other things, about healthcare are the prospects of a lot more government in it, depending on who wins the election this year in the U.S., is that all of a sudden healthcare costs have always been a consideration, but all of a sudden they're going to have to compete with every other item in the federal budget. You might not get your gallbladder operation because we got to go to war in Iraq or something. And the same people who will be doing your healthcare are doing a million other things with your money. In our state, there are many such examples because we have a constitutional amendment in Michigan that limits what government at all levels can take. And so that also limits whenever they're at that point and they have to reduce, they don't have the option of squandering it someplace else. But it's a never-ending struggle. It's a never-ending struggle. I mean, one of the things we learned from history about governments, and this is true of the best of them, as well as the worst of them, that is that they have an insatiable appetite for revenue. Doesn't matter how much you give them, it's never enough. And so even on occasions when they save some money, if the citizens aren't vigilant, there's that built-in tendency to want to squander it elsewhere. Yes, sir.
What do you think about the Iraq situation where the first time the U.S. military has contracted out many, many services to thousands of independent contractors in the private sector. And it can be argued both ways that those contractors have done a very poor job. They violated human rights. They've become wild men. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it could be argued that they replaced a lot of American troops by doing it in the private sector and eliminated the need for a lot more troops.
Yeah.
But why is it that for the first time the military has found it necessary to have all these contracts? You didn't seem to have these in previous wars.
No,
what's
this really.
Your opinion of how it worked?
I think the jury is still out on it. It is an unprecedented degree of contracting out. That we're seeing, and my guess is that the jury will rule when we look back on it someday that there were successes and failures both. On net balance, I don't know, because I don't know anything about how carefully the government is writing and monitoring its contracts. I do know that, keep in mind, we always judge the private sector by higher standards than we do the public. This is actually one of the virtues of the private sector. We kind of except waste and fraud and abuse and scandal in government because it happens all the time. But the moment that it happens in the private sector, it's like, oh, you know, we can't. I mean, Abu Ghraib was not a privatized scandal. That was a government scandal. But the private sector, it's as if every failure or what seems to be a failure of a private sector solution is a reason for government to come in. But we don't have that same way of thinking when it comes to what about every failure of government? Most of the time, a failure of government is a reason to have more government. There's a bias in, a bigger budget. There's a bias in our thinking automatically in that direction. So, but I'm grateful for the fact that we look at the private sector activity more carefully. We blow the whistle quicker. We're quick to yank the, that's one of its virtues. That's what Mayor Goldsmith said was so empowering in Indianapolis. We didn't do that with garbage collection when it was government provided, but we sure do it now that it's privately provided because it's easy to switch to someone else.
Larry, could you say something about the effect when a government declares instead of privatized, but actually offers 49%?
Oh, yeah.
So this is relevant because our present government has offered that for the privatization of telecoms.
Yeah, if you privatize, but you only privatize half or less of some function and retain government control of what's left, it's not really privatization. It is at best a kind of partial privatization, but one of the hazards is you can actually increase the perverse incentives for poor performance. When government is doing it as a monopoly, at least everybody knows who to blame if something goes bad. But if it says, well, we'll let private people have 49% of it, we'll keep 51%, well then, there's an incentive within the bureaucracy to kind of mess things up so the other 49 can come back under the fold at a later date. Instead of serving as an effective monitor, it becomes an obstacle. So I think, generally speaking, if you're unprivatized, do it wholly. But do it right. And this business of just selling off part of it, leaving government in control, is a disincentive for the best of providers. If they know that they're answerable to government bureaucracies who have very different incentives, they're either going to not be involved or not do as well as they might if it were free and open competition.
Yes. Thank you.
That's a very good question for the scholars at the Nassau Institute, who have much more in-depth knowledge than I do about the Bahamian government, what the opportunities might be. But I wonder if sometimes, it may not be the case here, but I know it's often claimed that these government enterprises are cash cows for the government. But when you look more closely at the real costs of what they do, they look much less so. One of the virtues of privatization is it gets governments, often for the first time, to really assess their costs for the first time on a realistic basis. Government accounting is very different from private accounting. I remember, to give a good example here, of a county sheriff in a nearby county in Michigan, when we were talking at our institute about privatizing jail management, the management of county jails, as has happened in other states. He said, oh, no reason to do that. He said, I can house prisoners in my county jail for $17 a day. And so I was with one of our scholars, and we started asking questions. Does that include the cost of the long-term unfunded pension obligations of the jail employees? Nope, that shows up in another line. I don't have to worry about that. What about the custodial and keeping the jail clean? Is that part? Nope, that's done in Parks and Rec or something else. In other words, the costs were diffused across multiple departments. He thought he was a low-cost provider of jail services. He wasn't. It was probably could have been twice that. But if you were to put that up for private competition and have a rational cost assessment basis, so you could really find out what is it costing government to do this, you'd probably find something very different than that $17 a day. So I wonder if this cash cow has really been subjected to a genuine, honest, full cost accounting, because rarely are government enterprises subject to that kind of rigorous accounting. Well, I've taken a lot, and I know that. Rick told me one last one a couple ago, so if we have time, I'll take it. Yes, sir.
I didn't know if you're interested in returning to the question of medical cover and the present debate in the United States among the Democratic candidates about how they're going to achieve that universal coverage, insurance cover.
Yeah.
In England, as you say, what has worked out has been a system where there's private cover to supply immediate services, and that is actually subsidizing public cover in the same hospital, where people are rationed on expensive procedures, and that is the only way it can work. Now, do you believe that the private sector, through insurance, can provide universal cover in the United States?
Can the private sector provide insurance, universal coverage in the U.S.? If by that you mean, if you do it entirely privately, will everyone have health insurance? I think the answer clearly is no. Why? Because in a free society, some people will say, no thanks, if I'm free to choose, I'd rather not. I'm young, I'm healthy, or whatever. Or it could be for foolish reasons, they may not buy it. Then the question is, well, would it make some sense, as we do with auto insurance? We say, okay, you have to buy it, but you get your car insurance from the private provider of your choice. And by some mandate, then everybody will be covered, but you don't get your insurance from the government. Now, although I'm very skeptical of that approach, it would be better than having the government leap headlong, full scale, into the kind of care that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama are talking about. We had a former Health and Human Services Secretary, Louis Sullivan, who put it well when he said, if the government ever really takes over health care, it'll combine the efficiency of the post office with the compassion of the IRS. And I don't think when it comes to health care that that's what we want. I think a far preferable route to go, and then whatever gaps are left, we can plug by any number of different ways, including perhaps a mandate. But a far better route is through health savings accounts, which in America I think should be expanded and encouraged. This is where we leave insurance not to something your employer gives you, but rather we leave it to individuals by allowing them to save tax-free in an account that accumulates, so if you're healthy and don't spend from it, it rolls over, it's yours, it can grow from there. But that fund grows tax-free and allows you to draw from it to pay the smaller medical bills. And health insurance then is left to those catastrophic occasions so that premiums are very low because deductibles are very high. And health expenditures up to the amount of the deductible are covered out of the health and savings account. If we moved in that direction, we would more of health care purchases would be personalized. You'd have less of this problem of third-party payers, which injects all kinds of bad incentives into the system. And it would be infinitely preferable, I think, to government taking over health care. I just don't think government has a track record that gives me hope that if it just took over health care, it would get cheaper and better. There's no reason to believe that. It's fanciful. It's utterly fanciful. No basis, no history, no record, zero. It can't get done, it seems, in America, efficiently, the core functions it's supposed to do. It still hasn't figured out how to deliver first-class mail, even though it arrogates to itself a monopoly in first-class mail, at rates that are at least two or three times the growth in inflation. So I'd like to say, until it figures out how to deliver letters, let's leave delivering babies and other things like that to those who know what they're doing. I have no confidence, and I would challenge people to tell me why we should have confidence in politicians to run our health care for us. We ought to be thinking of it more constructively of private solutions, not government solutions for such a critically important aspect of our lives. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Before I call on our President Joan Thompson with the vote of thanks, there are two things I forgot. We have also in the back of the room Maria Camargo, who didn't take care up here in the formal program, but she's one of our people that give us a helping hand, and we appreciate that. Also, in your packages is a little book that Larry gave his speech last year, is also a book, and he gave us permission to reprint it under the auspices of the almost famous Nassau Institute. And we'd appreciate you taking the time to read that. Some of you were here last year, but it's we appreciate that. But it's my pleasure to introduce our president, Mrs. Joan Thompson, to give the vote of thanks.
Hi. Thank you, Rick. And most of all here, thank you to Larry. He has done it again, as we must confess. Any of you were here last May, and heard him speak. He leaves you with some serious things to think about in the most pleasant way. That's all I can say. His presentation and the ideas he's put out there for us to think about, we can be thinking about for some time. We have these issues now facing our country. They are serious issues. And now we have some way of putting them into a context. And I hope you will be able to have, Larry, I don't know whether we have your permission yet, but we'd like to have your delivery here, your talk here, on our website. So if you want to go back and review any of the points he's made, please go to the Nassau Institute website. Hopefully they will be there. Rick will arrange it and find that, and then talk to everybody else about it. Get the idea going that privatization is the way our country has to go. I will say one thing struck me this morning, or was it yesterday? I saw the Prime Minister saying now they want to get the nationalization of health care back on track, castigating the former government for not completing their agenda. But by the same token, there was the health care thing that was going to come on. And then the other thing, he was talking about privatizing Patelco. Privatize Patelco, but nationalize health care. Does that make sense? If the principle is right for one, it must be right for everything. The principle and the broader aspects of it that Larry has outlined. So we have a really big disconnect going on in this country. I don't know if anybody can connect up the powers that be here to what needs to happen. But I don't see that. Does none of that make sense to me? So we should think about that. Larry, we have a little, you're a traveling man. We have a little because you take your good news and your interesting talks all over the world. We know he's been to Mongolia. I know he's been to Nigeria. Where else? I don't all know. But as a token, just a little thing of our appreciation.
Thank you very much.
Serves you well on your travels.
It says, do not open till Christmas.
Right. That's the plan. Thank you, Larry.
Finally, thank you very much for coming, and of course, remember our sponsors. There's a list there, and we really appreciate their support and you guys coming, and we hope to see you at the Don Boudreau event in March. Thank you so much.